You are listening to Art Not Science, presented by the Physics Room Contemporary Art Space, a monthly podcast of artist talks, panel discussions, and other events.
Tēnā tātou katoa. Nō mai hoki mai ki tēnei kaupapa kōrero o The Physics Room. Nō mai, whakarongo mai, whakatau mai. My name is Abby Kinane and I'm the director of The Physics Room, a contemporary art space dedicated to developing and promoting contemporary art and critical discourse in Aotearoa. Based in central Ōtautahi since 1996, we assist artists with resources and opportunities to enable creative and professional development and work to support the acknowledgement and understanding of contemporary art among New Zealanders. Our goal is to actively seek links between the arts and other areas of cultural production, and to involve art as a contributing voice in wider intellectual, social, and political debate.
Kia ora tātou. My name is Amy Wing, and I'm the curator at The Physics Room. Welcome to episode 50 of Art Not Science. In this episode, we'll be sharing an artist and curator's talk from our Te Waipo Namu offsite exhibition, Like Water by Water, a partnership between The Physics Room and Blue Oyster at the Egantai Art Gallery in Timaru. Like Water by Water brings together artworks from Delohana Lekamge, Suji Park, Carol Ann Bauer, and Fiona Partington. The exhibition adapts its title from the writings of self-taught geologist John Hardcastle, who observed and studied the unique geology of South Canterbury and made groundbreaking discoveries concerning climate change. Each artist in the exhibition draws from elements of the physical environment, limestone, fossils, pigments, and clay, materials imbued with speculative, relational, and ecological narratives. Delohana Lekamge's newly commissioned film, A Softer Limestone, returns to Ram Setu, or Adam's Bridge, a mysterious stretch of limestone shoal linking Sri Lanka and India. Ram Setu was also the subject of her 2021 film, A Different Ocean. The traces of meteorological events in the limestone terrain of South Canterbury evoke for Delohana displaced histories and diasporic longing for a distant other. Suji Park's ceramic sculptures recall archaeological relics, primordial creatures, and the plastic bonded rocks of emergent and future geology by fusing together seemingly incompatible materials from different sources and geographies. Fiona Partington's photograph, Powakai, stems from her ongoing project to document remnants of the Powakai Haast's eagle. Fiona has a long-standing affinity with the Powakai and the physical manifestations of it that exist today. Among these, the rock drawings found in limestone formations depicting them. Embroideries and paintings by the late artist Carol Ann Bauer intricately render in thread and acrylic microscopic fossils and minerals, sea anemones, and other oceanic forms, the kinds of marine organisms whose skeletal fragments have come to form the limestone landscape of South Canterbury. This talk took place between Delohana, Blue Oyster director Simon Polensky, and I at the opening of Like Water by Water. Let's listen to the talk.
Kia ora koutou, nō mai, haere mai, welcome to the Egantai. Thank you all for coming so much. My name is Simon, I'm the director of Blue Oyster in Aotearoa, Dunedin. This is the exhibition that Blue Oyster and the Physics Room have worked on together. Every year we work on an off-site project at another gallery around usually Te Waipo Namu. And we're really lucky and fortunate that the Egantai were willing to host us for this show. Yeah, Amy, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, sure. Kia ora tātou. My name is Amy Wing and I'm the curator at the Physics Room in Ōtautahi Christchurch. Yeah, like my colleague Simon said, we're really excited to be here in Timaru to bring some artists down with us to make show in response to the place here. I won't talk too much because really you want to hear from the artist who's with us today. But yeah, it's so wonderful to see you all this afternoon.
Kia ora everyone, my name is Delohana. I'm the artist who's made the work on this beautiful screen.
Amazing work.
It's a beautiful screen and a work that I made that I also think is beautiful. Yeah, thank you for having us here. It's been a really great opportunity to explore Timaru. We actually shot the second chapter of the work in Timaru and exploring the limestone landscape. So yeah, I'm really lucky to be here and yeah, grateful for all of you coming along.
Maybe before we jump into a more in-depth discussion with Dillo about her work, I just wanted to mention that some of the works in this show come from the Eglantyre Art Gallery's collection. So we have works by Carol Ann Bauer that are along this back wall here, alongside works that have been loaned by her daughter from her estate, which Simon and I have really enjoyed being able to exhibit again. I don't think they've been on show for quite a few years now.
Isn't no, right? Yeah. Carol Ann Bauer passed away, I think, in 2014 or 2016. And she was born in New York City and studied textiles and fine art and painting at the University of Connecticut and at the Eastern Connecticut Technical College. And then in 1972, when she had a partner and young kids, she moved here with her family. I think her partner got some kind of employment in New Zealand. And then through the 70s, 1970s and 80s, she was involved, I think, with a lot of the fibre textile art that was happening around that time period. So if you open that big New Zealand craft book, the Brian Brake photographs, there's like a little interview with her in there and some works, images of her work. The thing about Carol Ann Bauer, though, is that there isn't a lot of information about her out there. If you look at art magazines, she comes up in the more crafty kind of ones rather than the more fine art, if you want to make that distinction.
Mm.
And there's not a lot of her work in gallery collections around the country either. In my experience, I haven't really seen any before. And so when we started doing some research about this exhibition here at the Eglantyre, it was a really nice surprise to find out that they had these four works here on the right-hand side in their collection.
Yeah.
And the two on the left, which are acrylic on Perspex paintings, are from the artist's estate. And as far as I know, yeah, they might have been exhibited in the 70s and 80s, but for the most part, they've been in storage and that kind of thing. When we talked to Cara and Petrina and Hamish here at the Eglantyre, they can't remember a time that these works were brought out for an exhibition either.
Has it been like 40 years
or yeah.
So? Yeah, they've been acquired.
One of them was labelled as a ceramic on the database as well, so that is sort of like, you know, it's an embroidery. So there, I guess maybe not a lot of research and stuff had been done on them either. They're just one of those little interesting corners of a collection when you have institutions like this, you know. And then the Fiona Partington work photograph behind us as well is also from the Eglantyre collection. So that's quite... That's really nice to include because Fiona's actually based really close to Timaru now. So she was living in Tamaki Makaurau and now she lives in the Hunter Hills on a property out there. This is an earlier work where of a longer project that she's currently working on where she's photographing remnants of the Puakai Haast Eagle. And so I think this photograph was taken in 2006 and she's still working on that project. And she's actually really excited at the moment because the South Canterbury Museum here in Timaru has a lot of quite amazing Pauakai fossils and she's been granted access to come in and photograph those. So her coming down to the Hunter Hills is kind of tying nicely into her getting back involved with this multi-year kind of project. Yeah. But we can talk about that like a bit further on maybe. But.
Yeah. Maybe I can ask a question to you, Dillo, then. Would you be able to maybe introduce your practice to the audience, talking about one or two ideas that are sort of motivating what you're doing?
I'm kind of like a video-based practice and a lot of the way that I start my work is like through a whole lot of research, I think. The site that these works focus on is a site called the Adams Bridge or Ramasetu, and that's been a point of research for me for like, I don't even know, like maybe like 5 years, like quite a long time just looking into this really interesting site that is kind of like a real foundation to not only Sri Lanka as a country, but also like a foundation to a lot of kind of religious mythology and religious stories. And yeah, it's just kind of like a really amazing foundational site that I think a lot of people aren't really that familiar with. Like my practice is also like just really, really research based. Just a lot of
absolutely.
Picking up little bits and pieces of being like, oh, that's a sentence that I haven't found somewhere else. How can I fact check it? Mm. Or is there a way in which I can maybe shift it a little bit to suggest that that might have happened or that might have been part of the story without kind of saying it as fact, you know?
Yeah,
which is true of kind of that site trend to just find little bits everywhere else because it does have like multiple stories associated with it. So not one story is, not all of the stories are in one place. So it's a real like gathering kind of mission.
I think when me and Simon saw Carol Ann Bauer and Fiona Partington's work in the collection, I think we could kind of see a show starting to build itself around these two bodies of work. I guess they're both artists who are interested in different histories of the landscape. Carol, her work stems from, I guess, quite an intense observation of her natural environment and how that's tied into maybe her own kind of beliefs about spirituality. And Fiona's work, you know, looking at the rock art, it's maybe talking to a history that's not so well known in the region. Definitely because I'm from Tāmaki, when I came down here, I didn't know too much about that. So I think, yeah, their two works sort of gave us an entry to thinking about the landscape in a really expansive way. And also, I think linking Fiona's work to Dillo's, I remember seeing your work at Room Gallery. There's actually two works by Dillo Hanna that are in this show. The first one is A Different Ocean, and that was commissioned in 2021. Yeah, like Dillo said, it's set in Ram Setu, but I remember it was quite an incredible work because it's so evocative. But Ram Setu, I understand, is this limestone shoal, and I thought that was a really interesting way of connecting Te Meru to this other kind of distant place. And so when I invited Dillo to be a part of this show, I really wanted her to come down to Te Meru and to see the landscape and maybe build a work around that. Yeah, you talked about the different narratives that are within A Different Ocean. Did you want to maybe briefly describe the work as well?
I used a bunch of footage that I had when I went to Sri Lanka a while before that, and I hadn't looked at it before. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't intending to use any of it. It was all just like stuff that I had in amongst like photos of my auntie with this temple and stuff. So it wasn't something that I intended to use, but when I pitched this project, I was like, oh, I guess I have to use this footage. And I think it's like a real patchwork of information and also a patchwork of footage. I kind of approached it as if it was found footage and also used a lot of found footage of the actual site itself, because at the time that I made it, I think it was around COVID time. And also in itself, it's a really difficult site to get to. It is basically, yeah, a line of limestone shoals that is between Sri Lanka and India. And because there was a cyclone that happened in 1964 that basically disconnected a lot of the train line that was there and the towns that connected those two sites, the two countries. So it's a really hard place to get to. Also, like, who has the money? I don't have the money to like go and shoot off to Sri Lanka to like film a work. So it does kind of talk about this distance between this place that I would love to be at, but then also there is just like so many different factors involved of not being able to be there, and trying to maybe feel closer to it in doing the research and learning more about it and making something in response to it, so that, I don't know, in myself I feel more connected and in some kind of like selfish way, I don't know.
You are listening to Art Not Science, presented by the Physics Room Contemporary Art Space.
The newer work, Dillo, you've managed to do that really effectively, where there's the three different kind of elements to the work, where there's your own voice and narrative being talking over it, and then there's the footage from around Te Meru, and then there's also the found audio as well, which is based in audio from around Sri Lanka, right?
Yeah, so that's also found audio as well. So it's found audio of part of the rebuilt train, audio of that part of the ocean, and audio of also some of the birds that are from around that site. So basically the first work talks about these real amazing overlaps of religious history. So it's really significant in Hindu mythology, which is basically like the story of Rama and Ravana, who were these two kind of like this prince and this demon king. And this basically the end of that saga is like the reason why in South Asian cultures we celebrate Diwali. But then there's a site called Adam's Peak, where it's thought that when Adam was banished from paradise, he fell onto the site in Sri Lanka, which is where the mountain is, and then used Adam's Bridge, which is why it's called Adam's Bridge, to make his first voyage on earth. And then in Buddhist religion, Adam's Peak is also thought, because there's this indent in the land that looks like a footprint, and people think that's actually the foot of Buddha. And then going into this, a softer limestone, which is the new work, kind of making my own, or not making my own, but like creating a newer epic, a different epic that kind of is in response to these other epics, but is kind of a battle between the cyclone that was actually in 1408 AD and the limestone itself, which actually pushed the limestone underneath the ocean, which is like the way that it is now. And prior to that, it was actually thought to be above it. So kind of linking it together in the same way of creating a mythology or creating a kind of battle between these two, in the same way that there are these kind of epic battles in the history of that site, but also in that first text, my first work. Yeah. Coming to Te Muru, so the way that Amy kind of introduced it was like, you talk about limestone in this work, there's heaps of limestone here, and what could we do about it? And then just researching the kind of history of the limestone here, and also like the history of the breakwater and how like the train line was like kind of reconstructed as well. And there's also like really specific plants that depend on the limestone here, you know, and also just throughout Canterbury kind of, that depend on the limestone and heaps of different species. And then also how the limestone was like a really important site of shelter and, you know, speaks to the kind of rock art as well, of it being a kind of a home base as well, and how that is reflected in the contemporary site of what Adams Bridge is at the moment, which is a site of conservation. It is, has like a marine reserve there, and also has had train lines built on it, and continually they've failed because of the weather and because of the ecological site not necessarily wanting to be tampered with. In my head, that's how I kind of phrase it. But yeah, so making these links between this limestone that we've shot here and the limestone there in its two histories.
Yeah, definitely as we were sort of making the work, it felt really serendipitous because there seemed to be a lot of parallels in terms of, yeah, like the landscape of Te Muru and the landscape of Dunashkoti, because they're both sites that have seen incredible geomorphic change over the centuries, not just with the breakwater here, but in terms of deep time, I guess, with glaciers and things that have come and gone in the area. Yeah, there were lots of parallels that we could see between, I guess, the ecological site of Te Muru and the site of Dunashkoti that's very sensitive to climatic changes, but also, I guess, interference from humans as well.
Like one of the sites that we filmed at, one of the owners of the site was saying that some dock workers actually come out and make sure that they check specific flowers that are endangered species, and they come through every couple months and check on their progress and see how well they're doing. And then also they've like cordoned off that area so that those flowers actually have a chance to get through without like any of the livestock interfering with it. Yeah, which I really kind of liked in terms of like the care that is also kind of being taken into preserving a lot of the species that grow from the limestone, in the same way that there is, you know, the marine reserve and the kind of care that's been taken into the species that depend on the coral reef and the limestone and Adams Bridge as well.
Before, you talked a bit about, you know, this distance between you and Sri Lanka, or you and Dunashkoti. And I know you have, I guess, a personal connection with the area, and you sort of talk about it in A Softer Limestone, the second work, the new work. Did you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so my great aunt, who was like my great aunt Wai Ching, who was also one of the first like Chinese immigrants to Sri Lanka, she was my aunt by marriage. She went to this school, which is like the biggest kind of like girls' school in Colombo, Sri Lanka. They used to take day trips when that first boat mail express train line was around before the cyclone happened. So they would take day trips. They would go from Colombo on the train to the top of Sri Lanka and then take the ferry. And that's that same kind of line that mimics, or like kind of is parallel to Adams Bridge. And it's kind of interesting thinking about the way that the limestone is as a rock, in the sense that it is like fossils and all of the ancestors, I guess is the way that I phrased it, of like the species that live there that kind of die and get compounded into the rock, and the weight of the ocean kind of sits in there and it becomes this generational kind of site. And I think I like to link, like, it was nice to be able to link it to this kind of generational point of movement and distance. And
it's a really powerful idea that, you know, these sort of ecological species live in this very unique environment that they're adapted to and dependent on, but the environment itself is kind of formed by the descendants, you know, the ancestors of that same species throughout a long period of time, which is that's quite like a powerful idea, and so it speaks a lot to the connections between non-human elements of the world and then the sort of geology and landscapes that kind of surround people, surround it as well.
Yeah, I think picking up what you were saying, Dilo, I think as we were discussing the show, the limestone that forms, I guess, the substrate of the landscape of Timaru, it seemed to embed so many different timescales. So I sort of mentioned the different glacial periods, but there's also different animal and like non-human histories that are embedded in the stone, and also the kind of social and historical and political content as well.
Yeah, because politically also the Adams Bridge is like such an interesting site. Like at the moment there is a lot of discussion between India and Sri Lanka about whether or not to build a shipping route that will kind of go through Adams Bridge or be really close to Adams Bridge. And for a long time, the Hindu nationalist government opposed it because they say it's a sacred site, like so sacred to India, even though it is a sacred site not only to Hindu religion, but Muslim religion and Christian religion and Buddhist religion. But yeah, kind of co-opted to make it seem as if this is a site that is important to all of India. But it's actually important to all of India because of its Hindu connections, instead of it being important to India because of its connections to a lot of the religions that reside there. Which is interesting, kind of a double-edged sword, because yes, it kind of should be left alone because it is so important to the species that live there, but also not for like the Hindu nationalist reasons to leave it alone. And then it is still kind of a conversation between these two governments as to whether or not they're going to build that, and also the real economic benefits to some, and then also because it will take trade away from other ports in Sri Lanka, that it would actually affect a lot of the other kind of places there. So it is a really complicated place, even in its like current mode, even though, yeah, it was like complicated then, but it also has a lot of different layers now as well, which is why it's like great to kind of revisit it at this moment after I'd made this previous work, which kind of spoke about this more ancient history, and then looking at its more contemporary-ish issues as well, and how that history also is important to kind of touch on and is also really interesting to look into.
You are listening to Art Not Science, presented by the Physics Room Contemporary Art Space.
It might be a good time to introduce like John Hardcastle and his...
Yeah.
Because one really interesting part about the limestone and landscape around Timaru is that it's actually a really important site for paleoclimatology, I think it's called, which is basically the archaeological study of ancient climates. Limestone is a really good material for being able to go into deep time to study the shifting climate over tens of thousands, if not more, of years. And there was a man in Timaru who came over from England in the 1840s who was one of the first people in the world to realise this and to study it. And he wasn't a trained geologist or scientist, but it's all purely based on his firsthand research and observations of the coastal cliffs around Timaru. He was a really great writer as well, and he really brings to life the stories that you can kind of see in these soil deposits on the cliffs, where you can tell different stratum of glacial periods, and then you can see a much warmer climate with more verdant forest and things covering the landscape, and then it becomes another, it cools again, and then more glaciers come through and stuff like that. He was even able to tell when massive flocks of migratory birds were in the area, because you could see in the sediment the gizzard stones that they would use it to digest food and then offload before they flew when they migrated. And then the climate would change again and those migratory birds would go and they wouldn't come back, you know. And so He called them the dust heaps of history, which is quite funny, I think. And that kind of research is obviously really important for scientists studying climate change today, because some people might look at that kind of research and say, okay, well, this just proves that the climate just goes up and down, up and down, up and down, and it's completely normal. But the fact is that these changes were happening over tens of thousands of years rather than in the really short amount of time that we're seeing today, you know, basically since the Industrial Revolution. And it's interesting when you think about that kind of context in terms of species like the Pouakai, which are relatively recent arrivals in New Zealand. And so the theory is that they evolved from an Australian species of harrier, which was blown over to New Zealand, similar to how the Kotuku white heron, there's a population here that was blown over from Australia. And then once the harrier was here, it evolved over thousands of years to become this huge eagle, which was an apex predator. The Pouakai was able to adapt and live through these periods of glaciation and periods of warmer climates and things. But that's often, that's not the case in, with a lot of species today, because the change is happening so much more rapidly. But yeah, John Hardcastle, his writings of things are really fantastic. He was able to really evocatively describe these things. You know, you're looking at a little line of red and then a little line of grey or something, but he really brings it to life. And you can kind of feel what these environments must have been like and how vastly different they were to the landscape that, you know, where you're around today.
And I think for us, it was really helpful to think about the works by each of these artists through his research. We were thinking about the layers of sedimentation or the deposits that were left by the changes in the climate and how a lot of the artists in this show work in a really fragmentary way. And actually, you've made a great observation about Dillo's work before, how in A Softer Limestone, Dillo's got the kind of narrative voice that comes through, and also the footage that's shot around Timaru, not quite in a documentary style, but definitely from an observational kind of perspective. And then how there's also these, yeah, like found audio components that are all collaged together. And I think, yeah, that was really interesting to me. I wondered if you could maybe talk about that in terms of your filmmaking as well.
Sorry, that's probably quite a big question. I mean, like, the filmmaking was like me and Amy in her car, like getting it real dirty, and like me like falling down a lot. And yeah, that was basically it. But like, yeah, being able to access a lot of the properties that have like beautiful limestone cliffs that I would have otherwise never seen. And then also like sites like that's like kind of near Craigmore Station or part of Craigmore Station. And also like a bunch of the limestone bridges that were constructed. And yeah, kind of being able to put them all together. And I wanted it to be a little bit more suggestive, more than it be easily spottable. Like, I didn't want it to be like, oh, that's like this place. I want it to be a different world in itself, I think. Something that is more suggestive of a place, suggestive of somewhere. Because I am talking about a place that isn't actually shown in this video. It is described, and it is also like set up in a kind of audible way to have this background where it's suggested, it's suggestive of a place. And I think having these really textural close-ups of the limestone in its different kind of contexts, again, creates an idea of what this place might be like, what this place could look like, what the stone could, how it could function, what it could kind of harbor and give life to as well. So it is, yeah, kind of a suggestive of a different kind of site, because it is really like close up and really textural.
And there's, I guess, a lot of motifs or ideas or stories that are quite cyclical in your work as well.
Yeah, when I got to the second part, I really liked this through line of the limestone and the cyclone. Like the stone and the coral and the cyclone and the weather. It starts off with this battle, with this epic battle, and then it kind of goes through its more recent history, which is the cyclone that went through Dhanushkodi that also basically destroyed the train line. And it goes through basically how the weather and the site are really important to each other, and how they, like, despite the battle where the cyclone pushed the stone further into the ocean, it is actually these different factors work really, really cohesively together when they are kind of left alone to create this habitat, to create this reserve. that at the end of the piece kind of becomes a bit more harmonious and understood that they are more of a pairing instead of like enemies.
When you're talking about the idea that the films are quite speculative and suggestive, that's actually quite similar to how Suji Park operates, who does these colourful works that we're actually sitting between that we haven't really talked about yet. But, you know, Suji Park's ceramics, they combine elements of myth. And if you don't know Suji Park, she was born in New Zealand or in Korea?
I think she was born in Korea and she moved to New Zealand when she was a teenager. And she often talks about her migratory experience and that really informing her work. But yeah, like Simon was saying, she often will build ceramics and recycle fragments of her pieces into newer works. So in these works on both sides here, I understand that they're built from lots of different, almost incompatible materials. There's paper clay, there's regular clay, there's polymers, there's obviously plastic beads. And I think for her, it's almost like a process of archaeology where she's sort of digging into these materials or sourcing things from the environment around her.
And they're speculative in the way, or suggestive in that they're sort of doing that and then making these quite new forms that feel very of the future or something, or kind of reflect sort of emergent geology as, you know, in the future when we look back at geology from now, there'll be all these other inorganic kind of materials within them as well. And, you know, that people will be able to study and see. And there was lots of plastic in the environment and that kind of thing. They bring together different kind of stories and mythological kind of stories from Korea and from other kind of forms and things like that, you would say?
Yeah, for sure. So these two works are called Beet Doll, and it actually means light rock. So beet means light and doll means rock. And she, in the past, she's made a whole series of works called Doll. And she told us a really incredible origin story of those works where she made a silicon cast of some rocks that she stole from someone's studio. And those have sort of been the parent for all her successive works. But she found out afterwards that the rock that she stole was actually a piece of limestone. So that seemed like quite an interesting connection with the show as well.
Well, I guess like limestone itself too is that it is just kind of this aggregate of different elements and organic animals and things like that have been fossilized. You know, because the limestone beds in South Canterbury are from an ocean which was uplifted because of volcanic and earthquakes and that kind of thing, and then sort of dried out into stone over a long period of time. And it's similar to how the limestone operates all around the world, you know, including in Ramasetu and Sri Lanka as well, you know. So there's that unifying element to it as well, where the climate and the geological forms that geological actions that are happening kind of happen all around the world. And if you go back into deep time, you know, the continents were shifting and changing and were joined together and moving apart and that kind of thing as well. Shall we open up for questions?
Does anyone have any partai or questions for either myself or Simon or Dillo?
Yeah.
Yes, Simon, perhaps would be for you.
Sure.
Where do we access Hardcastle's writings?
Oh, well, so do you know Papers Past?
Yes.
Yeah, sometimes quite tricky to find what you're supposed to search for exactly. But if you look up John Hardcastle and Papers Past, you can find, because he wrote for the Timaru Herald, he would write a regular column. And so you can find a lot of his writings on there. There is also a book he published called Geography of South Canterbury. And apparently that's been reprinted in 2014 or so. So if you can find that at a library or something like that as well. But they're just republished newspaper columns. So if you can't find it at the library, you can find it on Papers Past. There's some information on the Te Ara encyclopedia and that about him too. And like I was saying before, there's a lot of modern day news articles about him because his field of study is becoming quite important and a lot of international researchers are finding out about him and citing papers that he wrote, you know, in the 1890s or something like that.
Yes. Question. Thank you. Talking about Sri Lanka, etc., the parallels I was thinking about was early Maori culture. And I just wondered how that was interpreted. And, you know, basically their footprint on early civilization, so you know you have diet and all those sorts of things and hunting, etc. And I suppose in a way that's going to affect, you know, what fossils that you find, etc., you know, going back through the different periods. And perhaps, you know, the Maori use of limestone.
There, you know, like I'm not the person who can speak authoritatively about those kinds of things, but I think, you know, when Māori first arrived into New Zealand, obviously a lot of environmental change happened. You know, the area of South Canterbury, you know, I can't speak to a massive amount of cultural significance that these places kind of hold for Southern Māori in particular.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to acknowledge too that in the same way to what Dila Hahn was talking about different interpretations, cultural interpretations and religious interpretations, it's the same here. There's a living connection as well, you know, like Fiona personally, who's Ngāi Tahu, she feels a really deep connection to these places as well, you know, and so these are living cultural significance. They don't belong to a past, they're alive today, you know. And
absolutely.
And so the way Fiona talks about this work, it's quite incredible how unique these shelters are and how special they are, you know. And she was describing how, you know, this drawing in particular was only discovered quite recently. And the reason for that might have been because it was in a limestone cave very high up on a cliff. And so you have to climb up to get to it. And it's very low when you go in there. And when you're inside, then on the ceiling is painted this puakai, you know. You get shivers when you think about that kind of thing, right? And Fiona feels that, and that's why she's so deeply committed to how she approaches photography, the politics of photography, you know, being the image taker and being a subject of an image. So it's not something that she handles lightly, and it might explain the long process that's taken more than a decade for her to kind of work through these processes and start photographing further remnants of the puakai and things like that. We visited the Rock Art Centre here as well when we were doing research, and when Rachel Solomon was talking about them as well, it's the same thing. And her interpretation of these drawings is very different from how Fiona interprets them as well. So it's not a single cultural narrative. There are multiple voices happening and multiple connections.
And I think that idea of multiplicity of voices was something that we felt came through in all the artworks. I don't think we were explicitly trying to draw a connection between any of the works to each other, but yeah, maybe just operate in this speculative realm.
Yeah, and it's fun to speculate, and I think it's almost like a fictive way of looking at historical facts or something like that, you know, like, and it's the same with Caroline Bauer. You know, Caroline Bauer's work in Suji Parts especially, it's so colourful and vibrant, and like, it's like a really creative interpretation of these like kind of foundational geological kind of aspects.
Like the crystals and the fossils and the corals and things that she was interested in.
So, Brenda, can you just touch on the heads or the forms that are over here?
Well, they're based on a type of traditional Korean mask, right? I think is what Suji said.
I think so. One thing that I didn't mention about Suji is that she is really interested in language. So obviously beat dolls is one instance of that. But I guess the names of the works, Wet and
Oyo.
So there were these O sounds. And I think for her, she was really interested in, I guess, like these onomatopoeic sounds. And this O sound kind of being almost like really foundational or like a building block of language itself. So these works actually were shown at the Douse, I think, last year, and they came from the same exhibition. Yeah, and I guess visually they're quite different, but I think they sort of operate in a similar manner where there's an investigation of language, of mark making as well.
No, and I think it's interesting to think about language as kind of really reflective of the materiality of Suji's work as well, where it is this kind of gradual hodgepodge of different elements. You know, we speak a language that is informed by a whole lot of different languages that have kind of come together to form this other type of thing. And it's reflective of that kind of, I guess, maybe part of that migrant experience in living between cultures and things like that as well. Should we wrap it up?
Yeah. Thank you so much for coming along to this talk. It's been wonderful having you. I did just want to say some thanks before we all have a drink, have some food. I wanted to thank the Egg and Tie Art Gallery who have supported this exhibition. They've been really amazing to work with. It's been such a dreamy install. In particular, I wanted to thank Brent, Petrina, Cara, Hamish, Di and Fran who supported us through the past week. And on behalf of Dillo and I really wanted to thank Mark and Amelia Dale, who let us film the limestone cliffs on their property, and to Adrian Kerr, who also led us onto his property to film the cliffs, and also to Mike Bolden, who helped us with the AV install, and to the entire Blue Oyster and Physics Room team that have supported us.
We're really appreciative of everything they all did, and we're so lucky that they could help us for the show. And I hope you all come and enjoy it as well.
Thank you so much. That was Dilohana Likamge, Blue Oyster director Simon Polinsky and I in conversation about Dilohana's new film commission, A Softer Limestone, now on show at our Te Waipo Namu offsite exhibition at the Egantai Art Gallery in Timaru. Like Water, Bywater runs until Sunday the 3rd of September, so please stop by if you are in the area. Our current show, Te Puku o Te Taniwha, also runs until Sunday the 3rd of September in our Ototahi Gallery. The show asks, what does a taniwha feed on? What does a taniwha listen to down the Waikato Awa? What dance moves does a taniwha have? And what if that taniwha swallowed the physics room? These are some of the pātai underpinning this exhibition, initiated by A.J. Futter, whose works sit alongside that of Kahurangi Arihi Smith and Tyrone Te Wā. The three artists inhabit the gallery as a space of transformation, where states can shift, collective energy and intimacy can build, and difficulty can be processed. Our next show will be a solo exhibition by Anna Iti, opening on Friday the 8th of September. More details to be announced shortly. Thank you for listening. Tune in next month on Friday the 15th of September at 8 p.m. for our next episode of Art Not Science. Ma te wa.
The Physics Room is generously supported by Creative New Zealand, the Christchurch City Council, the Rata Foundation, Three Boys Brewery, Scientech, and the Crater Rim.